Okay. Now, the readings are not only fun, but they're really enlightening, and we all agree to that. And today it's Genesis 6, and Psalm 6, 7, and 8. Psalm 6, 7, and 8, and Matthew chapter 5. So I think we all probably pretty much have the practice of when we're reading, following certain patterns. And one of the things that I think always comes out when you do three portions the way we do, the connections between them. And sometimes we build connections, and sometimes we manufacture some of these things. But in most cases, if we tie the three together, one after the other, read them, there's always some great insights. And we can sort of build thoughts from that. Now, let's start in Genesis chapter 6. And every time I've done this, I've started in the Old Testament and never really got too far in the New. So I've just sort of printed out some notes that I've made here that might be helpful to you. Maybe raise some questions for you to ask, and don't be afraid to ask. I printed it because I got a new word that you'll see in the little box down on the right-hand side, casuistry. And I thought that was amazing. I'd never seen the word before, but I saw it in my Expositor's Bible Commentary, which is my NIV Bible Commentary. And it's a huge commentary. It takes an entire 4 foot a section of my bookshelf, and the books are that thick. So it's big. And we'll have a look at what that word means. It's kind of an interesting word, God willing, when we get to Matthew chapter 5. So first of all, the flood in Genesis 6. Who believes that it was a local flood? I know you're not going to say it, probably. Hmm? Who believes it's a worldwide flood? Whole world. Kind of there. And the reason I raise this is because recently, in the last number of years, Robert Ballard, who was a university, I forget which university he works for, but he's the guy that found the Titanic, and he does undersea research, and he's been looking at the bottom of the Black Sea in the last number of years, and he's going back, I understand, in 2013 to carry on where he was in the last year, looking at parts of the bottom of the Black Sea, which are like 400 meters down, I think. And he's actually seen civilization there, foundations and actually human remains within the foundations and the stonework that's there. Now, maybe it's Photoshop, but I think we can probably agree that that's something that we always thought we would see someday. I always thought in my life that somebody would find something that would say, "Oh, there was a flood." This is completely unexplainable in any other way that there would be civilization, remnants of civilization, 400 meters down in the Black Sea. And that is part of a thought that has been out there for some time, that the flood was actually caused by a huge surge that came up out of the Atlantic Mediterranean, went through the up through the Black Sea, and then surged right up into the mountains of Turkey and Ararat. And the biggest argument I ever had on that was from Brother Ron Eason, who was a mariner, right? So he said, no, it was local. It surged up through there, and this is what Ballard is saying. Now, I don't think that that makes any difference whether it was worldwide or local. The fact is that there is civilization down there, 400 meters below, in the bottom of the Black Sea, which means that. That's a pretty good argument for the fact that there was a huge, huge a worldwide flood or something like that. Now, the language, of course, here is such that you could sort of do it either way. And I was looking at what it says about, and I probably should have written this down, but the way the water comes in, it says that the water swelled up, lifted the ark high above the earth. Verse 17 of chapter 7, 40 days of flood kept coming on the earth. And as the waters increased, they lifted the ark high above the earth. The waters rose in verse 18 and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. So the language doesn't preclude that. The language does suggest that, and does tell us, I think, quite clearly, that civilization was destroyed. It was overcome. And civilization in those days would have been in that corridor anyway. So it could have fit the text, I think, reasonably well. Now, I happen not to believe that. I believe that it was a worldwide flood, and I believe that because I think that there was a separation of the waters in Genesis chapter 1 that we were just reading a couple of days ago, and this thing called a firmament was established, which meant a circle of water around the earth. And part of that is because of my experience with greenhouses, because it was a greenhouse effect. It was a canopy that essentially made a moderate climate from pole to pole. Where the poles were, I'm not sure that makes a difference, but it certainly meant, because of this canopy, that there was pretty much even temperatures. And there was a huge climate change from the flood because, of course, God puts a bow in the clouds. Chapter 9 and at verse 13. Now, the argument is that you wouldn't have had a bow before. It didn't rain before. There was a mist that came up, so there was kind of a general level of moisture throughout the world, and there wasn't rain. And then after the flood, the effect of light on the earth was different, and so you could have these rainbows. And well, that's where I come from anyway, that basically God brought the waters back down onto the earth that he'd separated out. And you can add your opinions if you'd like. Anybody has any ideas? Assume that there were no other godly or ungodly populating the rest of the world. So if civilization was concentrated in that area, then a local flood could take them out. Question two is, what does he mean by world? What is the word that Peter uses? I don't think, to be quite honest, it doesn't affect my worldview, nor does it affect my faith. I mean, I guess some people would see it as a challenge to the biblical record, but there's a certain amount of ambiguity in it. In any case, were you going like that? Yeah. Okay. Not too vigorously, but just, yeah. In any case, there was certainly a climate change because things were vastly different after the flood, and I think the rainbow is an indication of that. Now, what else did I have down here? In the heavens. The outcome of the flood was that the wicked were removed, and God said he would never destroy the earth again by water. I mean to say, as Peter said, he wouldn't do it by fire, but by water. He wouldn't do it again. And you had a repopulation of the earth from the family of Noah, and three families that became the foundation of the Earth's population, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So there was a huge restructuring of things, and once we get into the Table of Nations in chapter 10 of Genesis, we start to see how that the world was populated by bands and tribes that moved out from these three sons of Noah, and that is pretty much the way it is today. We can, I mean, lots of things have been written about this, but certainly you can take the population of the world back down to three origins, and that's pretty biblical. Any thoughts on Genesis chapter 6? Further thoughts? The other thing is that I think we understand that there's only so much water, and it's available either as liquid or frozen or vapor. So that's it. Probably that's been true since creation, as we see it in Genesis 1. My favorite day of my life was when we had a guy that lived next door to us, who was a Christian pastor, who worked part time on the oil drilling rigs in on the North Slope of Alaska. In Purdue Bay. This was back in the early 80s. And he had a core, a drill core, that had palm fronds in it. And this was drilled from, he said it was quite common that they found meat and animals and palm fronds in the cores. And so he brought a picture of one back, because I was kind of going, yeah, right. And so he brought these back and was showing to me. It was quite fascinating. He says it's happening all the time up there. So clearly, it was something that at one point in time it was very, very different the way the Earth. Wasn't plain though, and mortise and tenon joints or anything. It was just a piece of wood. Yeah. So there's been some huge upheavals, and yeah. All right. The only other thing that to me was the giants, and that question always comes up. Last night it was, where did Cain get his wife? But we don't need to look at that. But the Nephilim. I don't know whether that warrants a bit of thought, but I think that as part of the every inclination of man's heart that was only evil continually, which is a very, very depressing thing when you think about it, that they were breeding. There's breeding big people. I mean, they fought wars with big people. And certainly, the bigger the people you had, it was like your atomic bomb, I guess, or whatever superiority you had in battle. And certainly, David was dealing with that with Goliath. And there was a number of them around then. So I think we can probably understand part of that simply by breeding practices. Anyway, that's my thought with that.
The name means the fallen one, doesn't
it? Yeah.
And the other query that I have while you're on about the ark, and that, did the people, apart from the family, did the people who were there and living in that area actually have an invitation to go into the ark, or did they have always a foregone conclusion that God had already decided and been able to foresee their only
No, it's an interesting thought, because Peter does say he was a preacher of righteousness, so I'm sure it wasn't just his building. He must have been, I've always imagined, he must have been preaching, talking to people and preaching to them about the rationale for building it. Nobody seemed to want to buy in to that. So whether or not it was a foregone conclusion that that might have been depressing for the people that Moses or Noah was preaching to think, well, there's not going to be very many that are going to go in there. Yeah, I forget how I recovered from that one, but it was fairly quick, I think. Yeah.
Verse 18 seems to say that the Lord will make and establish my covenant with thee. So it seems to be with thee and thy sons and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee.
Where are you?
Verse 18 of chapter 6.
Right. So that seems to indicate that it was decided who was going in.
See, the contrast actually between 17 and 18, where he brings the flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life from under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with thee. So there's the difference. So the only ones worthy of the covenant were Moses and his family, Aaron rather than his family.
Yeah, I already said that. Moses, yeah. which is more like my breeding argument. They bred these people.
Yeah.
There was no angelic interference in it. The text doesn't really require it.
No.
But it's what, you don't remember old Brother Doherty, do you? He called that papal packing, that idea, you know, because a lot of it was papal packing, but that was certainly one, because they already had a preconceived notion, of course, that there was fallen angels who came down to the earth. So that fit into that idea of where the devil came from and so on. So, but there's no valid reason for that within the text. Yeah, I think there's a textual reason for that at the end of chapter 4, and certainly chapter 4 hadn't been a good chapter in terms of the development of the human race, as truncated as it is. But the fact that people would actually begin to call on the name of the Lord, I think is significant. We get certainly a number in this line, or a couple anyway, including Enoch. And Noah, who became part of this line that came out of the end of chapter 4. But of course, these accounts are very, very shortened. We're only seeing just what the Lord wants us to see as we go through here. I'm going to go to Psalm 7 now. Now, one of the first things I noticed about Psalm 7 was that there was this character that David is singing concerning. He sang to the Lord concerning. In the top of my NIV Bible, it says Cush, a Benjamite. Now, this is kind of peculiar, and I kind of wondered what that could possibly have meant. And there are three Benjamites in David's life. And I've got them recorded here. I think they are the three. There was Saul, of course, was a Benjamite. Shimei was in 2 Samuel 16 and 5. And Sheba, the Benjamite, in 2 Samuel 20, verse 1. So the second and third Benjamites are obviously, we're obviously allied to the house of Saul, and we're taking up an issue with David as his enemies. And siding with the Absalom revolt. And so there was some bad blood that had been there for a long, long time in relation to the house of Saul, who was a Benjamite. So the hostilities were there. They were deep. And whether or not the title of this particular psalm was symbolic of the Benjamites, they're called Cush, which may well have been a kind of a pejorative sort of a term towards Benjamites. And I can't imagine any other reason why David, in fact, I can see why David would call this psalm out and direct it to Benjamites. Well, I don't know any other reason why it would be, but there certainly seems to be some very good reason why it is, because there were three Benjamites who played a really big role in David's life. And they weren't nice people in many respects. And if you look at the structure of the psalm, there's some reason for seeing David now singing and writing about his enemies, these fierce enemies that he has. I can't see what's on the desk there when it's down there, so let's just have a look. Verse 1, of course, David says, O Lord my God, I take refuge in you. Save and deliver me from all who pursue me. Well, This is a fundamental position of David's, I think, over and over again, that he takes refuge in God. These weren't, I don't think, idle words with David, you know, because sometimes we say, well, God willing, or God take care of you, and so on. But David, I think, had a really, really deep and abiding faith in the fact that God would save him. And, of course, I think he had lots of reason to believe that, just because of how his life unfolded up through the days of Saul and into the days when he received the kingdom. He was a survivor, for one. I mean, I always think about that God had saved him over and over and over again. He could look back over 20 years of being pursued and another, 20, 30 years of kingship and all the enemies that he had. And here he lived, he died in bed at 70 or whatever it was. God had clearly defended and been a refuge for David. People pursued him, and in verse 2, they would have, if God hadn't have pursued him, torn him up like a lion. I mean, these are really graphic terms, or rip me to pieces with no one to rescue me. His foes were vicious and cunning and relentless, and so he uses this type of words. So the first two verses, he's establishing the fact that he takes refuge in God. But secondly, and this is kind of, I think, the logical sequence of the thinking of a righteous person. I start with my foundation that I trust in God. Secondly, I got to look at my own hands to see whether or not this problem is of my own making. Now, I have to say that because I had sort of a good Jewish mother who said that it was my fault. She was convinced of that. And when I said that in one of my classes at the college, I got a call from somebody up on high that said, you don't say good Jewish mother in your classroom. And I had to make an apology and an explanation for that. But anyway, this is what I'm saying here, that he says in verse 3, if I have done this and there is guilt in my hands, if I have done evil to him who is at peace with me, or if I have caused, without cause, robbed my foe, then let my enemy pursue me and overtake me. That would be right if he was that way, and it would be justice even from a point of his God who he took refuge in. Let him trample my life to the ground and make me sleep in the dust. David could see that there could be a cause and a reason for this. And so he had to examine that. He had to look at that. Then we go to verse 6. And in verse 6, we sort of move to the, I think one of the cornerstones in David's thinking was that God took retribution. He didn't. And I think this comes up in psalm after psalm after psalm, where he leaves judgment to God. And I think that's true with Saul, certainly with Saul, because he wouldn't put forth his hand against the Lord's anointed. He would not interfere with the process that he believed was the will of God. Certainly, I think, in the two later Benjamites, in chapter 2 Samuel 16 and also in 21, he stood off and said, leave him alone. This may be, the hand of God, and the Lord will deal with it. So he takes this position. So he lets God have retribution. Then as you move on to verse 8 to 12, having said that God was his refuge, having said that if there was any reason why he had caused this problem or created this the reason for these people to be chasing him and treating him that way, then he needed to be judged. But then he moves on to accept the fact that whatever God's judgment was would be right. So if we accept God as our refuge, we've had a look at our own lives and where we're at, and we've left retribution to God. We don't judge. We leave that to the Lord. Then we have to rely on God's righteous judgment. it follows. We can't question what the Lord does and how he deals with retribution. And so I think in verse 8, let the Lord judge the peoples. And David, of course, would accept that for himself. Judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness, according to my integrity. God is righteous in verse 9. He searches the hearts and minds. And so he wants God to bring to an end the violence of the wicked and make the righteous secure. That he didn't see that as his job at that point. It was the Lord who would do that. And verse 10, my shield is God Most High, who saves the upright. God is a righteous judge, verse 11. If he does not relent, he will sharpen his sword. In other words, what God will do if you don't relent, God won't relent either. He will pursue until he has brought justice. Verse 13, prepared his deadly weapons, makes ready his flaming arrows. The Lord is prepared to pursue it to the end. Verse 14 is an interesting verse, and I don't know what you have in the King James Version or what version you have. He who is pregnant with evil and conceives trouble gives birth to disillusionment, is what the NIV says in verse 14. He who digs a hole and scoops it out falls into the pit he has made, verse 15. The trouble he causes recoils on him, his violence comes down in his own head, and a certain sense here that you reap what you sow, and so therefore whatever God's righteous judgment is, it's correct, and people bring it upon themselves, and God will judge. But anyway, in verse 17, at the end of the chapter, do we give thanks and praise the Lord for his righteousness and sing praise to the name of the Lord Most High, which really, if we accept God as our refuge and our strength, as David did, if we examine our own hearts to see where we stand in relation to all of this, if we then consign judgment and retribution to God, then we trust in his righteousness that it will be right, then we praise his name for it. And I think that's really the structure of Psalm chapter 7. And it's not unlike many of the Psalms that we read, especially those penned by David. Questions? Thoughts? Well, they didn't of course have a temple, but they certainly had, and as far as David was concerned, they didn't have a temple, but they had worship services, I'm sure, and his music was becoming part of that whole thing. But no, I think that this is a specific reference to the Benjamites that had caused them trouble. So this was personal. This psalm seems to me to be personal, simply because of the structure of it, and also because of what the heading says. I don't know what you've got in your Bible. Is there a heading on the psalm? Maybe no one else says Cush the Benjamite, and I might be going in circles here. Yeah. So I think this was specific. He had trouble with three Benjamites. Yeah. So I don't know what everybody else's view is that, but I personally think this is personal. He wrote this with three Benjamites in mind. That's my point here.
It also says it's a really passionate thought. A wild, passionate thought.
These three men were a huge problem for David. A huge problem. Saul at the beginning of his life and these other two jokers at the end of his life, they were really, really nasty people. Imagine just being pursued relentlessly by as he was by Saul, and then these other two men who just came out to just embarrass him in as much as they could in front of and to degrade him. And of course, they wanted the kingdom to go back to the Benjamite tribe. I think that was certainly part of the rebellion. They were seizing an opportunity to try and take the kingdom back. And they weren't on Absalom's side either. They were just out to restore the kingdom to Saul. Chapter 6 has some interesting thoughts, the same type of thoughts. Chapter 8 is really a connection back to Genesis, the Genesis reading. And also goes forward to Hebrews chapter 2. And maybe we can come back there in a bit, because I'd like to have a look at the New Testament. Unless you all object and say, no. Chapter 5 of Matthew. Matthew chapter 5 is... I think needs to be seen the way most of the modern versions present it, and that is in sections. You know, if you go to the King James text, it's not so good at kind of immediately highlighting these various sections. And so therefore I think, and Gordon, you've got the new, English Standard Version?
No, I've just got
A.B. So... did they paragraph it too? Or are there paragraph headings? No. I mean, you really, really need to see that, because you can see it by reading it as the thoughts change. But in mine, it's just they're headed. We've got headings on them all. The Beatitudes, first of all, to verse 12, and then salt and light, for example, verse 13 to 16, and then. The fulfillment of the law is another piece that comes from verse 17 to verse 20. And then some thoughts on murder, which we can have a look at. And then some thoughts on adultery in verse 27. And then divorce in verse 31. And then taking oaths in verse 33. The principle in the law of the eye for an eye, which I think I had to kind of stop and give some thought to that. Because on the surface of it, there seems to be some inconsistency here in what Jesus is saying. And I think that's where my word came from. Consistory. Yeah. So then finally, you have the piece from verse 43 to the end on loving your enemies. So Jesus is presenting these ideas in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 pieces, separate sort of statements that are cohesive in themselves. I think it helps us a lot when we're reading, just sort of seeing what's in the text. Salt and light, I think I've made a comment here about... consider how what this means to us when he says you are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world. How that kind of affects 21st century, early 21st century Christadelphians with 175 year history of whatever it is that we do, and how dramatic is this statement of Jesus for us to be salt and light. I know we think of salt as being kind of seasoning, flavoring, and light, of course, is light. And how dynamic is that in our lives? Now, what came to me is that we have... an ongoing discussion, conversation, I think is the current term, within the community, worldwide, not only within our ecclesia here, but worldwide, over the concept of exclusion and inclusion. So there are a whole bunch of compelling verses, biblical verses that tell us that we should be exclusive, and that is to exclude people from our midst. There are other, a whole other group of verses, probably just as many, and probably just as compelling, and maybe more so, depending on which side of this you sit on, that says that we should be more inclusive. And this, of course, is at the very heart of the unity debate that I was raised on and is still raging away in North America especially, probably not so much in, I don't know, maybe in other parts of the world, but certainly raging away in North America. Should we be a body that is exclusive and therefore narrows down our thinking and pushes other people away so that we become sort of narrower and narrower and more exclusive as a community? Or do we become more inclusive and try and bring people in? And, you know, we've been having discussions at our CYC, about the CYC at our AB meetings. And this is fundamental to how we see a lot of what we do, I think. Certainly in CYCs and Sunday school, should CYCs be inclusive, that is to say, bring people in? Or should CYCs, on the other hand, be exclusive and protect our kids from, you know, other people coming in? Now, it's fundamental, and I think we need to think in terms of this as a community. We have Bible exhibitions. That's being inclusive. That's going out and asking people to come in and to share the message that we have. So salt and light in that context, I think, is a challenge to us. Because if we're exclusive, we're not being the light of the world. You know, so again, I have my verses and somebody else has theirs, and they're both biblically correct, unhappily for us. Both arguments have weight, a biblical weight. And we struggle with that discussion. I'm not sure we're going to ever resolve it, but it needs to be understood that we do have that discussion, and Jesus comes along and said, you are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world. Is that inclusive or is it exclusive? Well, I think these verses are on the inclusive side. No sense being the light of the world unless you're prepared to bring people into the light. No point being the salt of the earth unless you're prepared to savor their lives and enhance their lives and bring them into the light of Christ. So that's just a comment in passing, because we need to be thinking about these things, because these arguments are at the core of a lot of things that are going on in behind the scenes in our discussions. Now, there's a couple of simple ones here that we all understand the principle of. Murder. Now, nobody's committed murder in this room, as far as I know. But we have been angry. And of course, this comes back to my word here, which we'll get to in a few moments. If we're angry, I'm not saying if you're angry, you might as well kill him, right? That's not what Jesus is saying either. The fact is that we're being told that the external act of murder is one thing and is dealt with by the law, but the real motivation behind murder is anger and jealousy, and we had that with Cain and Abel. So that's part of our reading yesterday. Cain just was ticked off by his brother. And, you know, I think you go through Genesis 1 and 2 and 3, and then in chapter 4, Cain kills his brother. And what a way to start God's word. But we have to, I think, step back and say, this is what we are. So it starts with anger and those types of feelings, and then it goes to murder. But Jesus is really saying, you've got to go back to the heart. And there are some comments that Jesus makes here about the use of the word raka, and this is evidently an Aramaic term of contempt, kind of something you would say, a nasty thing, and so on. But anyway, the fact is that what is important is that we settle matters quickly with our adversaries in verse 25, because sometimes these things can get out of control. And so the faster we can resolve these things, the better. And also, we know it says don't murder and nobody murders. It's one of the Ten Commandments. But we have a much bigger problem, I suggest, with the idea of anger. Verse 22. Now, adultery is really the same thing. Because, see, well, we don't do that generally, but looking, and last thing, is that what I had here? Looking and fantasizing as adultery. Now, last week we were doing the readings, or last week we were doing the readings in Job, and he said in, was it chapter 31, verse 1, he said he's made a covenant with his eyes, so he didn't look, which is a good way around this to resolve the problem. So Jesus is saying that we don't even look. A divorce, this is not a comprehensive statement about divorce in Matthew chapter 5. There are a couple of more comprehensive and inclusive verses. This one on oaths is an interesting one. And I have to share with you an experience I had a number of years ago, maybe 30 years ago now. I, from time to time, put in damage reports for events that happen to people's yards. For example, what we would call trespass. You know, I had a client in Souk, and the neighbor was getting a landscaper in to do some work and thought, it's a long way to his backyard going this way, so why not we just cut through the neighbor's forest with my cat and take down 900 trees and build a road there to get into the backyard and so on, or down to the waterfront or wherever that was happening. So those types of things happen where there's huge damage done by trespass. It happens quite often, and I've been asked to, and also with ICBC, you know, somebody drives through somebody's front yard. So as part of what I do, I put estimates together. And there was a claim that came out back in the 70s that my lawyer was defending somebody, and there was what we would call and what the court would call a spurious complaint against my lawyer's client. In other words, they were trying to make money out of something that was trivial. So I had valued this thing, and I'd got subpoenaed to come to the court that morning. And before I went, I said to my lawyer, his name's Jack, you know, I don't want to do that swearing on the Bible thing, Jack. You know that. So what are we going to do? And he says, oh, they've got this thing where we can sign this affirmation. So I said, okay, but I don't want to be dealing with that. So you set it up with the clerk. He says, I'll talk to the clerk. And when we get to that point, she'll just bring it out, and you'll sign this thing and get on with your testimony. Now the problem was, it was a bit complicated because my lawyer had been involved in this thing a few months before and had perjured himself. And so therefore, he had the senior partner of the firm there, and he was there, senior partners to defend him, and I was there to, you know, provide expert witness and so on. And just as we were getting to the point where we were going to do our thing, a grade 11 class from Claremont shows up. And I thought, we're in trouble now, because these judges in the small claims courts are not always lawyers. They're very often not trained in the law. They're kind of, you know, people who, you know, are good people or whatever, have some history, but not necessarily lawyers. And the guy that was there that particular day, my lawyer said, oh, we call him Aunt Ruby on the bench. And I thought, this is not going to be a good day. So now, of course, along comes the Bible, right? And so I said to the clerk, oh, by the way, my lawyer said you were not going to do that because I don't do that. And so I need to do the affirmation. So she had forgotten, and she didn't have the piece of paper. So she got scolded by the judge, and the judge told her to go and find it. But in the meantime, the judge thought, well, I'll talk to the students about this whole process, about, you know, you don't have to sign, swear on the Bible, you can sign the affirmation, and so on. But to increase the drama of this, the plaintiff, the people who are representing the plaintiff, that's the guy that's suing, isn't it? The one that's aggrieved? Yeah, complainant. Were East Indians. They were Sikhs. And when they came into the courtroom, the senior partner in my law, in the law firm of my lawyer, leaned over to me and says, Clyde, I'm going home. I said, what are you doing that for? Frank, we're not, you know, I don't want to. No, Clyde, it's okay. I'm going home. There's no sense in me being here. I'm going back to the office. And as he got up to walk away, he said to me, oh, and you don't need to worry about telling the truth today because they don't. Now, well, it's so much for the law. But so anyway, to cut a long story short, he said to me, so why won't you do that? Why won't you swear on the Bible? Which I guess was a good question. I was standing there shaking in my boots thinking, I hope he doesn't ask me that. Because I've forgotten whether it was in Matthew 5 or Luke 7. So he did. Really, the grade 12 class was there, grade 11 class was there, so why not? So why won't you send them, Mr. Snow? I swear. So I said, well, because the book forbids me to do it. I'm doing it. Oh, I said, I never heard of that before. What are you talking about? Where does it say that? So I picked it up and I said, well, I think it's in Matthew. He said, you think it's in Matthew chapter 5? Then he said, oh, he said, you don't need to bother with that. I'm going to dismiss this case, he said. He said, I think it's spurious. And we're just taking up time here at the court. So he went, bang, and it was all over. These poor guys. From Vancouver, we're going, but we had this, right? But it was done. So it is, you know, if you ever get into that kind of a situation, it's pretty clear. Matthew 5, do not, verse 34, swear at all. Now, why don't we do that? Because we can't make, either by heaven or by God's throne, or by the earth, or by Jerusalem, for the city of the great king. We have no control over any of this stuff. Why would we bring God to bear, witness to bear? Don't swear by your head. You can't make one hair white or black. You have no control over any of this stuff. But simply let your yes be yes and your no, no. And I never got to tell him that, right? It was kind of like, you just cut me right off like that. I was right, though, Matthew 5 and 33. So if in verse 37 we simply let our yes be yes and our no be no, we're okay, because anything beyond that comes from some type of manipulation or evil or bullying or you know, some other type of thing. And all we need to do as far as the Lord is concerned is just tell the truth. Yeah, they do have a piece of paper that you're supposed to sign, but yeah.
Just an eye of firm and that's it.
Yeah. So in fact, you're just saying, my yes is yes and my no is no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that provision is there. Happily for us, you know, if we ever get in that situation, it's there in law. So that's the thing about oaths, anyway. Why would the Sikh swear in the Bible and this Christian guy wouldn't? I mean, it's like, this is weird. Right? The students were going like, yeah, it's fine. Now, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This seems, to me, a little bit more difficult. This is where my word, kasurdri, we'll end here. Jesus doesn't allow for causicity. That is to say that it's a cause and effect thing. You put out my eye, I get to put out yours. And I think it's, is it Exodus that goes even beyond that and says bruise for bruise? Yeah, Exodus 21 says bruise for bruise. It was absolutely a cause and effect justice that was done. As he injured the other, so shall he be injured. Leviticus 24:20. Show no pity. It was clear. Whatever that was, you break a leg, you break a leg, and so on. How do we link that with the law and how that works? And Jesus is really saying, no, there is no resolving of specific cases of conscience in the little box or in the right, or conduct through interpretation of ethical principles or religious doctrine. That is to say that we don't base our judgment and our response to people based upon the legality of the law, as maybe the people in Jesus' day would have more, but also in relation to what we know as legally we can get away with today, or what the current legal system would allow. We don't do that. We have a higher level of response. And so he says, if someone demands your shirt, give him your coat. And this was obviously one of the things that you could have been faced with in those days. Somebody or a soldier said, you know, pack this thing for a mile, do 2 miles. That isn't kind of a cause and effect thing like the law, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. We have a much higher principle. The real direction indicated by the law, in any case, was love, rich and costly, and extended even to our enemies, says the Expositor's Bible Commentary. But we have a different way of doing things. And that, of course, is summarized in the last piece about loving your enemies. David was certainly an example of that. And certainly in loving his enemies, he didn't wreak vengeance upon them necessarily. He let the Lord do that. So his principle was that the Lord would bring about his righteous judgment. And Jesus, of course, was the ultimate example of this when he said, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. So Jesus was, you know, supporting his own position here by saying, you love your enemies, you do good to those who persecute you. And that certainly was demonstrated in David's life as well. Anyway, I think it's time.